Chapter 15, The Coming Flood. Back when the animals and people could talk, Xian Zhuang told us through Ban a bear used to come and raid the corn the brew people had planted. "Why do you eat our corn so much?" the people asked the bear. "You should pay us something to compensate us." "But I have nothing," said the bear. A year later, the bear returned to the cornfield, now with her cub. This time the people captured her baby. They planned to keep the cub till she was big and then eat her. But as the little bear grew up in the village, the people began to change their minds. The adopted cub never hurt the village children. She didn't even steal food, but waited politely for the people to bring her meals to her. Everyone was impressed with the little bear's intelligence as well as her gentleness. Because the people had the chance to live with a bear among them, they came to understand something they hadn't known before, Xian Zhuang said. A bear, he told us, is just like a person. And that's why the brew don't hunt bears anymore. Xian Zhuang knew much about the brew, as well as the other people here. A Pang speaker, he grew up in this district, in a stilt house his parents made by hand, where everyone farmed rice, corn, and tapioca, and fished with bamboo spears and nets woven of palm fiber. He knows everyone, Jim had told us. They'd worked together on the Nakai Namtun survey. Xiang Swang would be able to translate languages that Bun could not, and also he would know the current road conditions and which villages we could most productively visit. His help would be crucial, as we only had tomorrow left before we would have to leave the Annamite Mountains. Although meeting up with Xiang Zhuang had been uncertain, he's often away for days in the forest visiting different villages, the hope that we could find him was the reason for our long drive south to the Nakai Plateau. Although the town of Nakai is only 46 kilometers away, we had driven all day from Lac Sao, taking a circuitous route because the direct road was washed out. Bun, Gary, and I had loud, dramatic colds by now. Bun was still ceaseless in his smoking, but when he would get out of the car, he would pause to clear his sinuses by discreetly blotting one nostril with a thumb and shooting the contents of the other to the ground. Lacking his talent, I filled the back seat of the Prada with piles of sodden Kleenex and sucked foul-smelling lozenges to ease my sore throat. Gary's cold was characterized by what we called a turbo sneeze. It came on without warning, usually outdoors, often in response to sunlight, and resulted in a sound so impressive and flamboyant that I would often involuntarily step aside as if I might be blown off balance by its stormy gust. Through all this, though, our driver, Boonjan, was miraculously unscathed. Although we arrived in the town of Nakai tired and sick, locating Xiang Zhuang gave us a lift. We were lucky to find him. He was chief of the Service of Labor and Social Security in Kamoan Province. Xiang Zhuang was much in demand now that the dam was under construction and 4,300 villagers would need to be relocated. But when we first met him, I was certain he could not be our man. Jim had told us the guy was more than 60 years old. Instead of a venerable-looking elder, we met a small, smiling, handsome man wearing a blue Nike jacket with jet-black hair and a full set of strong white teeth. The only evidence suggesting he might be more than 30 were wrinkles that blossomed at the edge of his eyes when he smiled, which was often. Xiang Zhuang was obviously thrilled to see Bun again, so although Gary was eager to pepper our host with bear questions and I was hungry for his stories, we let the two friends catch up. Together they spoke in Lao as we shared dinner that evening at a little restaurant along the side of the road. Nakai has a raw, masculine, Wild West feel. Like the American West during its period of settlement, this is an area in the process of being overrun by speculators, many of them foreign, some of them outlaws. It's a town filled with men and heavy equipment for building the dam and for taking out the trees that will soon be flooded, and probably many trees that wouldn't. On the drive here, we had passed dozens of trucks heading in the opposite direction, laden with huge logs. When we arrived in the dusty, barren town, one of the logging trucks was broken down at the side of the road. A quick count of the tree rings showed the severed trunks had belonged to trees at least 150 years old. The restaurant where we ate was surely the Laotian equivalent of a saloon, but instead of swinging saloon doors, a single curtain stood between diners and the red dust of the road. As we walked in through the curtain, a dog walked out, exactly like a human patron. Inside, it was loud and smoky. Several dogs and one puppy patrolled the dirt and cement floor for scraps. I was the only female patron. The male diners talked and drank and smoked as tape Thai music played, and a soft porn video showed slender Asian women who had somehow acquired enormously fat breasts. The restaurant, like most of the other buildings in this town, was indeed hastily erected to serve the loggers and truckers and consultants working on the dam. It is one of the biggest growth projects Lao has ever undertaken. Its supporters see it as a remedy for poverty. Lao PDR is a poor, sparsely populated country having a rugged terrain, limited infrastructure, and a weak manufacturing base, the World Bank report on the project explains. It then details the litany of Lao's economic woes: subsistence agriculture, a weak human resource base, increasing inflation, depreciating currency, declining tax revenues. The country's growth prospects, read the report, depend to a large extent on the pursuit of sound macroeconomic policies and the sustainable development of two main resources available to it, timber and hydropower. With help from the World Bank, a foreign consortium is assisting in the construction and operation of the $1.3 billion project. Électricité de France, Transfield Holding Limited of Australia, and three Thai companies. We met a Bangkok-based Nepali survey consultant at the restaurant who saw the project as little more than a money grab. He, too, mourned the logs leaving the forest, the villages that would be obliterated by the flood. "Here in this country, when I see it, it is a pity," he said in perfect British-accented English. "Everyone wants the pocket to be heavy. The money you get today is the benefit. It is terrible to see it." We seemed to be a long way from any place or time that the animals and people could talk. "Eh!" With this incoherent complaint, I roused the scientist from sleep at 2 a.m., as Gary's eyes flew open, I announced to him, "There are ants all over the toilet seat." Our last day in the Annamites began inauspiciously. We had spent the night at a picturesque lodge. It had been built, we were told, for a Thai princess. Intricately carved throne-sized teak chairs and huge coffee tables faced the dirt road from the front porch. The view from the back porch was spectacular, overlooking a stream crossed by a bridge also built in her honor. For the moment, the bridge was prevented from collapse by three poles propped against its listing side, placed in the shimmering water. "The princess, she stayed one night only," Bun told us. "That was 10 years ago. It appears that may have been the last time the place was cleaned. Gary and I were allotted a little suite of two adjoining rooms and a shared bath, through which roaches audibly scuttled. There was electricity, but no running water. To flush the Western-style toilet, you had to scoop water out of a tile basin and dump it in with a bucket. There was no sink. Hanging on a nail was a black beach towel of dubious history, and on a teak dresser, a used toothpick. That the roaches had not eaten the mouth detritus still clinging to it suggested the toothpick was of recent vintage. I'd been wakened in the middle of the night by the pain from my worsening sore throat. Unable to do anything about it, I thought I might as well get up and pee. When I flicked on the fluorescent light in the bathroom, however, the idea lost its appeal. The toilet seat was crawling with many dozens of enormous black ants running around and around. Both the thought of having nearly sat on the ants and the question of what might have attracted them to the toilet seat in the first place made my original errand lose its urgency. I decided now to share my latest natural history observation with the sleeping scientist. Gary's reply came instantly, with clarity and resolve, and not a trace of irritation. "I will kill them," he said, and the biologist in shining armor went to work. When I next awoke, I had better news to share. "I think I'm getting better," I announced to Gary, as if bestowing a thank-you gift for his chivalry. Though his cold was surely uncomfortable, he never complained about it, but worried constantly about Buns and mine. "I've heard that before," Gary answered skeptically. In fact, I'd repeated that phrase like a mantra every day for the past 3. Prior to this, I'd insisted, "I'm not getting sick." I could no longer hold on to this particular fiction now that my every cough was followed by an involuntary moan. 2 days later, after Gary had shined a flashlight down my raw throat to reveal it was red, swollen, and spangled with white spots, he took me to a Bangkok hospital, where we discovered I had strep, and where I was issued an antibiotic so powerful it killed off my gut flora for 6 months. But in the meantime, I'd tried to treat my ailment with Tom Yum Pla, the spicy fish soup that I not so much tasted as applied like a poultice to my mouth and throat. I ate it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and for several hours afterward it obliterated all pain, as well as all taste and feeling, and my mouth would run with saliva like blood gushing from a wound. My sore throat was an apt metaphor for my frustration. As a writer, words are my only power. Now I felt powerless in so many ways. Everything seemed tragic and disjointed. The paralyzed moon bear at the zoo owned by the logging company, the Chen people's vanishing language, they characterized the state of the forest and the cultures here, increasingly paralyzed and silenced by the encroaching hand of modern greed. And again, it felt like everything was going wrong. If there was a new species of bear in the Annamites, it might have been represented by the poor, paralyzed animal at the zoo owned by Pudoy. But we had not been allowed to pluck hairs from him, even though, due to his tameness and disability, this would have been all too easy. And now, although we had found Xianxuang, he told us at breakfast we could not make it to the place where the Malingbu lived, the group I especially was eager to visit. It was 3 days' walk from here. Bun, sick and easily winded from decades of chain-smoking, certainly could not have made the walk. Further, it would not have been ethical to bring an unknown sickness to a remote people. And besides, we would soon have to return to the States. But we did have this day, and thanks to Xianxuang, we've made the most of it. "The animals may no longer talk to people," Xianxuang told us at breakfast, "but they still speak among themselves. At least, that is the legend he learned as a child, as he told us at breakfast. For instance, gibbons, monkeys, and the slim-bodied leaf-eating langurs are constantly communicating, as if the three species were all part of an extended family. How do the people know? When the gibbon sees food, he calls, and the monkeys and langurs come running through the trees to share the bounty. In fact, all the different animals talk together, all but the tiger and the bantang," he told us. "They fight with everything. But the legends say that even the tiger obeys the laws of the forest, laws that have been worked out among all the animals. The laws," he explained, "keep things in balance. And here is the proof. If the tiger ate all the wildlife, everything would be finished," Bun translated. "Inside the jungle, if there is a salt lick, there you can see all wildlife there together. Animals, they sometimes fight each other, but always there is a balance. For here, they do not fight, and you may even see tiger and deer together, proof there is a law." The people, too, once took part in a compact among creatures, he told us. For instance, his people, his mother was an ethnicity he called Cree Pong, and his father, Cree Num, came to an agreement long ago. After discussing the matter with the animals, all the parties agreed that the horse, the elephant, and the buffalo would live with the people and help them with their daily lives. The fish volunteered to be the food of the people, and so his people became skilled fishermen. "And the tiger, the snake, and the dole said nothing," he told us through Bun. "This is why the tiger, snake, and dole are never mixing with people at all." His people long believed they were the older brothers of the animals, as well as all the other people. A flood myth similar to the Jewish and Christian tale of Noah's Ark pervades many Southeast Asian cultures, in which people took refuge from the rising waters, not in a boat, but inside a huge vegetable. In the Cree version, when the water subsided, his people were the first to come out. Because they were first, they were like elders. It was their job to look after those who followed. So the Cree have an ancient tradition of nonviolence toward all other creatures. Bun corroborated this. I remember during the French period, when the Cree went into the military, they never went into the field to fight. The grandfathers told them to shoot into the air instead. But the draft in 1950 brought a change to the culture. The boys drafted into the army were given meat in their rations. At first they were disgusted, Siang Swong said, but there was little other food, so they ate what they were given, and gradually they acquired an appetite for animal flesh. When they came home, they wanted meat, he said. By 1960, everyone in his village ate meat. There have been many changes since then, he told us, but our cheerful companion was sanguine about change. After all, he has attained a position of high status in the district government. His four sons all have survived. Three are farmers. One is in the army. Before, translated Bun, the ancestors knew this was our area. We who stay here, we know how to behave. But now there's a mix between. The ancestors did not want contact between the different people. Now the ancestors do not speak to us. But today, we are happy. We criticize the ancestors. We used to have to move around and live in the jungle. We are happier now. But such was not the case at the villages we visited together later that day. The 37 Bru-speaking families of Khon Ken Village have lived here for more than four generations, fishermen, farmers, and hunters. Fishing nets hang inside the neat thatch-roofed stilt homes. They tend to spend more time in the forest than at home, they told us, through Siang Swan and then through Bun. But this month, December, is the time to stay home. It is the time they burn the fields. We had seen no animals, not even birds, on our long, bumpy drive to the village, but the forest around them, they say, is still full of life. They did not know golden bears, nor did they know of the Mong's giant mountain bear, but they did know of two kinds, they told us, the larger, the moon bear, called Jack Ao, and the smaller, the sun bear, Jack E Ao. Less than a kilometer from this house, a bear came to eat nuts, called Ko Num, just last year. The 200 people of the village like it here, they told us. No one remembers any other home. They don't want to leave, but what can they do? The government people have told them their village will be wiped out in the flood once they build their dam. They came to talk with us about it so many times, one of the men complained to us through our translators, but that didn't change anything. They will still have to move. Ban Bua Ma, too, a village of both Bru and Tai Bo people, will also disappear in the flood. We drove for an hour along a bumpy track from Khon Ken to get there, Bunjan skillfully crossing several shallow rivers in the Prada. The village has been here more than 30 years. Most of the stilt houses are thatched, but some have shingles. A few have metal roofs. Some are decorated with gifts from previous visitors. The home in which we sat and talked boasted a bye-bye polio poster as well. All of the children had been immunized. There is also a poster from the Center for Protected Areas and Watershed Management, featuring pictures of endangered animals, animals who will lose their homes, too, when one quarter of the Nakai Plateau is flooded by the dam waters. The people of Ban Bua Ma were exceptionally welcoming. They shook our hands with both of theirs outstretched. They seemed delighted to talk with us about animals and viewed Gary's Rogues Gallery of bears with great interest. And one of them immediately recognized the photos of the golden bears. A Bru wearing a checkered shirt had seen a golden bear in November 1992, he told us. It was at the top of a mountain in Xiangquang province, on the border between Laos and Vietnam, when he'd been there with the army. It was a big one, he said. He estimated that if they shot it, it would take more than two strong men to carry it away. But they didn't shoot it, even though they all had guns. They ran away. What is this animal? He had asked his comrades. Villagers at the nearby Mong village of Ban Tong Puk later told him it was a particularly dangerous kind of bear. If you shoot it and it doesn't die, they say, it will attack you. They had never seen a golden bear near this village, though, they told us. They had both sun and moon bears living nearby, which they clearly identified from our picture book. They knew a lot about them. They described the sun bears as the more tree-loving of the two types. They knew when the mothers first brought the babies out of the den, June or July, and they knew the bears sometimes built nests in the trees. They described how the bears loved to eat honey, and how when the bees would sting them, the bears seemed impervious except for the sensitive nose. The people, too, love honey, they told us. They use smoke to drive the bees away from the nests so as not to kill them. They also make a prayer to the pea or spirit of the tree where the bees lived and offer some of the honey to the pea afterward. Likewise, they make an offering, alcohol plus a sacrificed chicken and pig, to the pea of a field before they clear it. They're aware of displacing other lives in order to assuage their own needs, and the pea have taught them it is morally necessary to atone for this. Spirits are around all the time, they told us, even though you don't see them. But the pea see you, and if you do not behave properly, they will retaliate. Sometimes they will send a tiger to discipline the people for wrongdoing. Like Xiang Shuang's people, they too had a legend that the people and the animals could once talk. And remembering this, though they hunt many animals, they honor the compact among the creatures. They never kill a bird who is sitting on eggs. They do not cut down trees to collect the fruit. They do not kill any animal during its birthing season. Why, we asked. The mother, the father is angry, Bun translated for us. Please, generosity. You would not want someone to kill your baby. What will happen when they move to the new place, we asked. Where would the pea who advised them go after the flood? Perhaps, one of the men told us, laughing, the pea will take a helicopter. At the end of the day, we said our grateful goodbyes to Xiang Shuang and dropped him off at his office near town. We left Nakai at sunset, in a cloud of brownish dust. Like the way your vision slowly browns out before you faint, the dust blurred and effaced everything. The jagged limestone mountains, the green flesh of the trees' leaves, the plastic chairs and plastic tablecloths inside the little cement and dirt-floored restaurants, the men trying to repair their broken-down logging truck. The road and its dust seemed to be acting like a giant, dirty eraser. It smeared the outlines of the ducks and chickens in the road, the shapes of the trees and houses. Because of the dust, you could hardly see the glow of the people's fires outside the houses along the road. You no longer felt the shock of seeing so many severed and blackened tree limbs. Perhaps the dust was erasing everything. Even the memories of the time when the animals could talk, even the powers of the pea and the voices of the ancestors. No, I thought, the dust does not erase exactly. It clouds, it blurs, it confounds, like smoke from an opium pipe. The effect, rather than erasure, is to make you think, for a dangerous moment, that you no longer care what is dirty. But before we left the Nakai Plateau, we begged Xiang Shuang and Bun to let us take a walk in the forest. Boonjan drove us to a park-like setting beside a sign that read, Nakai Nam Thun National Biodiversity Conservation Area. After a 5-minute stroll through a very young forest of regenerating saplings, our path was blocked by several cut trees. Here Bun let us go ahead so he could enjoy another cigarette and talk with Xiang Shuang. Within a few minutes, we passed through an area that Gary called the doorway. Once through, suddenly, we were in real forest. It was young. The oldest trees were perhaps only 100 years old, and among them we found burned stumps and banana trees, evidence of recent cultivation. Bun later told us that only 3 years before, this area was added to the larger protected area. But instantly, once through the doorway, as if at the behest of some cool green goddess, the temperature dropped 10 degrees. The air smelled for the first time not of dust, but of life. The vegetation was now luxuriant. Everywhere, the precise triangulated leaves of bamboo, the graceful tracery of vines, the embrace of living wood and breathing leaves soothed our souls. It was quite different from anywhere else we'd visited in the Annamites. We stood quietly and soon understood why. For the first time on the trip, we now heard the voices of birds. They twittered and chattered, uttering waving notes as if from the throats of flutes. It was as if they were singing the melody called forth by the leaves themselves. We counted 8 distinct bird calls within a space of 5 minutes and spotted some of the singers. One was a drongo, an elegant insect-eating bird with long, elaborate tail feathers whose shafts are bare of barbs except at the tip, here called Nakseau. Gary and I waited and let the music refresh us. Finally, he said, "So this will be an island." Actually, we could not know how much of the land over which we had just walked would be flooded by the dam. No one did. The Nepali surveyor we met at the restaurant told us no matter what the reports claimed, no one really knew how high the water would rise. But surely some of the mountaintops, if not this one, would become islands amid the dammed waters. What would that mean to the creatures who lived there? Island biogeography, Gary reminded me, is a study of isolation. The animals here, without the chance to exchange genes widely with their neighbors, would be genetically cut off from their neighbors. Islands, for this reason, are places of transformation, as Darwin showed in his study of the finches of the Galapagos. Because they are cut off, the fauna of islands are also more vulnerable to extinction. If some cataclysm befalls their populations, their numbers cannot be augmented by immigrants from adjacent territories. But the isolation is also, perhaps, protection. Poachers seeking easy money, selling bats to be smoked as local delicacies, capturing bears to sell their gall to pharmacies, and killing tigers so their penises could be made into soup, would find it too difficult to hunt the animals here once the mountaintops were surrounded by the protective moat of water. Perhaps, for the mountaintop survivors, the deluge would be their savior. According to many cosmologies, the world begins with water, dies with water, and through the power of water, all life is reborn. The Hindus say the Creator sleeps on a cosmic ocean, dreaming the universes into being. The Jews and Christians say the formless earth began as sea, until the Spirit of God, moving over the face of the waters, called the dry land to appear. The Dayak, a head-hunting tribe of Borneo, agree. The Supreme Being, whom they call Ranying Hatala, spoke to the primeval waters in the voice of thunder. But he used a great dragon, essentially a naga, to form the foundation of the earth. Our gods often use floods to wipe away the sins of the world. Flood myths are among the commonest in human cultures. There are 302 of them by one count. In the Shan myth, an angry Indra first sends hosts of lion cranes and serpents to eat the impious, and then tries to kill the sinners with a terrible drought. Finally, the thunder god settles on a flood to wipe the slate clean, but 7 couples seek refuge in a giant dry gourd. In the Mong version, a brother and sister are the only survivors of the flood, having sheltered in a large funeral drum. The Cree hid in a vegetable. The Lao, whose lords had escaped by floating to heaven on a raft, emerged after the water had receded from a gourd that grew from the nostrils of a dead water buffalo. From death follows new life, the stories promise, just as the bear rises from her grave-like den with her cubs in the spring. We have kept our flood myths alive all these millennia because they speak to us of new beginnings. Humankind needs to remember that even in apocalypse, there is hope for redemption. When the dust settles, we can learn to see clearly again. We can emerge from war to make peace. We can turn from greed to compassion. The scientist and I drank in the cool of the young forest and watched shafts of light pour down like blessing from the openings in the forest canopy. It produced what photographer friends have called God rays, beams of soft light that painters of cathedral walls bestow upon the images of the saints. It was late afternoon, but it felt like morning.